an introduction by Lori Wagner, this tape will consist of the opening address Gary Rosenthal gave to the International Enneagram Conference held in August of 2000 in San Francisco, California. The title of the address is Love and the Poetic Tradition.
There's a remarkable poet beginning to attract national attention. His name is Gary Rosenthal, and this fall, Point Bonita Books is bringing out his first full-length collection, a book of ecstatic love poems entitled The You That Is Everywhere, which is already receiving uncharacteristic early praise, such as the following assessment from fellow poet David White, who writes, "It is easy to achieve a surface effect from the passion and intensity of romantic love, but more difficult to sing from the wisdom that underlies all the longing. These poems are not only true to the intensity of one man's deep love for a woman, but exhilarating for their insight, humility, and humor. A remarkable literary achievement and a gift to anyone who dimly remembers, half anticipates, or heaven forbid, is presently blessed by the rigors of a passionate love." Gary Rosenthal has worked as a fire lookout ranger in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, lived for a number of years as a Zen monastic, and spent 10 years running a charter fishing boat off the California coast. He makes his home in the San Francisco Bay Area, where he currently supports himself as a psychotherapist in private practice. In addition to having authored The You That Is Everywhere, his poems have been anthologized in Parallax Press's What Book? Buddha Poems from Beats to Hip Hop, winner of the American Book Award, 1999. He's currently finishing a book on the goddess Persephone, as well as another collection of poetry. Without further ado, I'm pleased to present Gary Rosenthal.
The organizing theme of this conference is to be the wholeness of the three centers, the head, the heart, and the belly. And I've been asked here as a poet to bring something to the table for the heart. So for the last few weeks, I've been working on this talk, and by last Monday afternoon, I thought I had finally angled something together that might possibly fly. But my sense of assurance was short-lived, because by Monday evening, something was niggling at me. And what was niggling at me was the sense that I might have created a Big Brain 2 kind of talk, something that may speak to the logos of the heart, rather than to the heart itself. And so, somewhat abashedly, I'm not sure if what I brought you today is really what was wanted of me. But then again, as that modern troubadour Van Morrison says, too late to stop now.
When I first studied the Enneagram with Claudio Naranjo, the public reputation he had in parts of the then nascent Enneagram community was that of somebody who had added psychological flesh to the skeleton of the Enneagram. And for some reason, this notion, this image of a skeleton has stayed with me, such that I began to envision the Enneagram as this giant skeleton, maybe that of a woolly mammoth that has been dug up, perhaps lacking not only its psychological flesh, but maybe even some of its original bones. The image suggests that some of the Enneagram's original body has become lost to us. Oscar Achazo, the Angel of Revelation, the Surman Brotherhood, Gurdjieff, Sufis, Plotinus, Pythagoras. The very controversy that has existed about the true origins of this system prior to its relatively recent transmission in the deserts of Arica, Chile. The very uncertainty about its earliest roots, its origin, in itself seems to argue for the notion of something having been lost, as if the Enneagram has grown orphaned in some way, a bastard tradition, no longer able to speak to us of its earliest forebears and its own patrimony. This isn't a bad thing, for whatever might have been lost has also made possible and necessary the capacity for reformulation and regeneration, with the result being that the Enneagram can't be put into a museum. It can't be understood and codified once and for all, but instead is actually a living tradition, much like a language is a living tradition, with new elements constantly being added. And this has stimulated the work of many people, some of whom will be speaking to us over the next 3 days. People who have also labored to graft some flesh to this skeleton, that the skeleton might come alive for us now and help carry us through some of the funky, dense, and jungle-like regions of our own psyches, as it might have been able to do for men and women in its distant past. So it's in this vein that I posit, with the license given to poets, because there's nothing I can prove, the premise of a lost tradition. There seems to be a parallel here to another tradition, another skeleton I've stumbled across, the tradition of love poetry. And it's this tradition that I want to speak to you about today. In fact, I really would have liked to have just read you some love poems, but I wasn't sure if I'd get away with it. What happened to me was a while ago, I spent about a year of my life being pretty whacked out of my gourd in love. And it was as if a giant wave had kind of taken me to some other unfamiliar, not particularly rational shore of myself. And along with me, deposited along with me on this other shore, was a book of new poems, The You That Is Everywhere. And when this period in which the poems were flooding through me, this year, you know, came to an end, and the poems again slowed to a trickle, I had to look back about this year that had just ended and ask myself, you know, what was that? And I didn't really know. I'm a psychotherapist by trade, and it was sort of galling in some way. It irked me that I didn't have much of a psychological handle on what had just happened to me. And so I began to read. I began to read things that had been written by and about other poets who had also been known for their love poetry, and other human beings who had also been somewhat overwhelmed by their experience of love. And in the course of my reading, I began to see that there were certain commonalities, certain things that had been reiterated in my experience, certain ways that my experience had reiterated the experience of poets, most of them, strangely, who had lived about 7 centuries before. So this reading also made me more aware of the tradition of love poetry and of the historical and psychological factors to which it had risen. So I'd like to now spend the rest of my time with you this morning giving you a little fragmentary sense of this tradition, of its logos, as it were, as well as reading you a few of my own love poems context by the tradition. So that's the agenda here. When it comes to love poetry, as with the Enneagram, there too seems to be the sense of a lost or a buried tradition, such that love poems in our time have become almost an extinct species, somewhat akin to that woolly mammoth. Robert Bly once wrote me, "Love poems are hard to come by these days," he said. And he then wondered whether it was because what he called the large she or the small she that had fallen into forgetfulness. And similarly, the poet and critic Dana Gioia writes that love poems in our time have become the great neglected tradition. But it hasn't always been like this, because about 7 centuries ago, there seemed to be a great wave of bhakti energy, a great wave of eros flooding the planet, and love poems seemed to be everywhere. This was the time of Dante and Petrarch in Italy, and in France, there were the Provençal troubadour poets. In Germany, the mini-singers, and in the East, there were the great Persian language Sufi poets like Rumi and Hafez, and there was the Sufi sheikh and poet Ibn Arabi, and born the same year as Hafez in 1320, which is the year before Dante died, there was the great ecstatic lady poet Lala, who moved through Kashmir without the benefit of clothes. Today she'd probably be arrested, poetic license or not. But back then, it seemed every country had a tradition of love poetry, more or less in full flower, the poets all more or less contemporaneous with each other, and all of them writing, or at least the ones that I've mentioned, writing with a kind of eros in which personal love seemed to be wedded to something deeper and more spiritual, just as in the Enneagram, the personality has something deeper standing behind it. And so I'd like to read you a poem from my book that touches one notion of that which lies deeper, an imaginal someone or an invisible other that stands behind the personal beloved and behind ourselves. And this poem is called The Others. Fruit was ripening in the summer heat. All that time, I loved you in fever without removing so much as your blouse. Then, in that burning, you were with another. No, not him, but the one who was waking in back of me. 'Twas good we didn't pick the fruit too soon. While the sugars were rising in to the limbs. So many poems flowed in on that tide of sweet arising, and it must be the other we thank for them. Now, alone with you, we make love almost every night. I wouldn't trade it, but still, sometimes, I miss the other who stands beside me, not of this time and not of this place, for when he is here, it is possible to meet the other woman, that one who stands in back of you. How many of you were following the recent Middle East Peace Summit? Show of hands. What was the main bone of contention? What was the one thing that nobody could compromise about? Jerusalem. And by the 12 and 1300s, people were already fighting about Jerusalem. This was the time of the Crusades. And the Crusade and pilgrimage routes, followed by Western Europeans into the Holy Land, brought them into contact with Sufic material that entered the Western poetic tradition for a while, before seemingly disappearing not too long after the Catholic Church waged another so-called holy war, this one against the Gnostic Cathars during the Albigensian Crusades. One of the Sufic influences I've mentioned, Ibn Arabi, had a transformational experience while at the Black Stone at Mecca, strikingly similar to what Dante later experienced when he caught a glimpse of the beautiful young Beatrice and found that it opened his heart and perfumed the rest of his life. The lady's name in Ibn Arabi's case was Nizam, and in gazing at her, he had an epiphany, one in which he seemed to realize that the beauty of the personal beloved somehow straddled two worlds, for in that instant, Nizam was both a human person and at the same time a manifestation of a personal God wanting to be known. This sense of beauty, which so moved Ibn Arabi and later Dante, is not something superficial like the beauty of a supermodel. Any poet worth his salt is going to want a better muse than that. The beauty I'm talking about is something that mysteriously resonates like a chord of deep music, from the essence of its bearer to that of its perceiver. This experience of beauty is a little hard to find words for. It's a little hard to talk about. It's a little hard to understand, maybe because when we can let it in, it seems to apply a kind of conscious shock to the rational mind, thus opening us to what lies deeper. In the Sufic tradition, Jamal, or beauty, is one of the 99 names for God. So this beauty that we love and long for and sometimes lose sight of can remind us of who and what we really are, and of what everything really is a manifestation of. When Dante, this is so strange here, like if I can talk over here, I feel like I get mic. When I try to look over at you guys, nothing happens. So don't feel I'm neglected. What?
Put in the center?
Okay.
It's the middle path.
The middle way. Okay. This is great. What was I talking about? Dante? Have I talked about Dante? No. When, When Dante plucks at the same deep chord, I was using that chord thing. When Dante plucks at the same deep chord, he says there's a Lord of the heart that he calls Amor, A-M-O-R. And he says that Amor may lie slumbering in us for months or even for years, and that at some point in a man's life, he might meet a savvy woman, so beautiful to his eyes that some longing might begin to arise for her. And if one isn't too quick to try to physicalize or sexualize or literalize this longing, that the longing in itself can begin to help the slumbering lord of the heart to thaw out or awaken. This was my experience as well. I'd fallen in love with somebody whose beauty just completely obliterated my defenses and melted my heart. Yet she was already involved in a relationship of long standing that she couldn't seem to leave. And so for about a year and a half, all I could do was go on long walks and talks with her all the time, the longing continuing to build. It's as if the longing brings up something deeper from its depths. Maybe it brings up a frozen love creature, the creature from the Black Lagoon. Maybe it brings up a frozen love creature preserved in a glacier-like region of the heart. A glacier-like region that the longing itself helps to melt. Maybe it brings up the longing for God, the longing for our own deepest selves, for our own deepest selves. Maybe it, what is it? I'm just talking. Maybe it brings up what Bly called the large she. When 7 centuries after Dante, something similar happened to me, here's how I first began to speak about it. This is the first poem in the You That Is Everywhere, and it's called Wild Hooves. The love poems I want to write had not been lived. Embarrassed, I now want to burn, sweep, erase all evidence of how I've loved before. And the crust that had covered my heart trampled by wild hooves of your beauty. So it seems there is someone or something beautiful, potentially transformational, and a little mysterious that may flicker forth from behind the person of the beloved. But what does it mean to be a savvy woman? Or for that matter, a savvy man? And what else did our poetic ancestors know about love that we've perhaps lost sight of? It seems the 12th to 14th centuries had something in them that promoted longing and knew how to work with it. A good time to be a four. If there can be such. Unlike our own time, this wasn't an age of fast food, instant telecommunications, or instant gratification. And there seemed to be a different erotic rhythm back then with a lot of waiting involved. There also weren't a hell of a lot of ideas in the air. No journals, no internet, no TV, no radio, no public libraries. The printing press hadn't yet been invented, so very few individuals even had any books. There wasn't much in the way of conferences like this. And so, perhaps the heart work, often the hard work, of intimate love relationships became one of the places where numbers of people who weren't in monasteries first learned to cultivate some kind of interiority. As I was saying, the erotic rhythm back then was likely quite different than what I, and maybe some of you, grew up with in the late 1960s or early 70s, where you might meet somebody at a gathering, maybe a rock concert, perhaps smoke a little dope together, and then maybe an hour or two later be making love in the back of a VW van. Does anybody else remember it like that? What can I say? Well, things were quite different in the time of the troubadours. And in the French troubadour tradition, if you were a member of the upper classes from which the tradition of courtly love originated, marriages were usually arranged. And by your family. You weren't so much marrying an individual as you were marrying into a family. And the marriages were arranged for economic, political, and religious reasons. not for reasons of the heart. And so the real, juicy love bond, where some inner work might have actually taken place, wasn't usually with the person that you were married to. And besides, if you were a woman, you were being married off at about 15 or 17, and the man you were marrying was often about twice your age. So there was a huge discrepancy in life experience, and you might not even have much to talk about with your husband or your wife. Maybe not too different than some contemporary marriages. And so in the troubadour tradition, real love was regarded as something that existed outside of marriage. And so men and women often took lovers outside of their marriages, a tradition that has lingered ever since in French culture. A little 70, we might say. Here's a poem that might be a descendant of the French troubadour tradition, with the beloved's other man entering at the poem's end. It's called, How Could This Be? How could this be that at my age I've become a virgin and write love poems for the very first time? How could this be that now I love like a waterfall, giving everything away without being diminished? How could this be that when the great world wants to give one of its secrets, it hides all else, making even heaven and earth disappear? Since this is the case, how could this be that you love me back and hold me like the banks of a river and yet still sleep with another? The time of the troubadours, time of the Crusades, was also the time of feudal societies where vassals pledged a devoted allegiance to their feudal lords. This sense of being a vassal to another, another that one placed above oneself, is a significant metaphor that gives us some entree into the headset of this period. There was actually a ritual where this was done, where you proclaim your allegiance to the feudal lord in that same gesture, that as that classic one that we now associate with a man asking for a lady's hand in marriage. The chivalric gesture, the lowering of the mast of ego, and the metaphor of being a vassal became central to the poetic love tradition. Both Dante and Ibn Arabi speak of this implicitly. They call it fedele d'amore, the vassal of love. Here, the poet-lover's humbled stance towards the lady probably was a corrective reaction against the extreme male chauvinism that prevailed elsewhere in the wider culture. He says, clunking once again. Okay. What was I talking about? I'm talking about lowering the mast of ego and this thing falls. Okay. And the humility. whenever one can find it. And the humility, when it was genuine, had something of the quality of bhakti devotion in it. This seems to be the yeast that elevates some of the romantic poetry of the tradition, enabling a more transpersonal dimension to enter it. In this way, the poetry written to the lady that I'm evoking here, in the tradition that I'm evoking here, has much in common with the devotional literature written to the guru in some of the Eastern spiritual traditions. But unfortunately, this stance of devotedly placing another above oneself doesn't seem to play so well or occur so naturally in a ruggedly individualistic, democratic, me first, narcissistic culture as ours, and perhaps our relationships, as well as our poetry, are the poorer for it. So a poem now that both touches the chivalric flavor of being brought to one's knees, as well as waiting for the beloved to become available. It's called What the Body Remembers. There are gestures which must surely come from the 12th century. My body remembers them. The 12th century, when romantic love first entered the West, heart time of troubadours. And I too feel a certain kind of love entering my heart for the first time. Though this is not exactly true. There was a girl. Her name was Cameleer Buckley. It was raining. It was 1956, and I waited. In the love of the 12th century, one is always waiting. And in the time of waiting, the time of being apart from the beloved, that's when many of the purest feelings come. I waited for Cameleer Buckley to emerge from second grade so I could carry her over a mud puddle, throw my jacket down before her feet, and I did. Waking up this morning, thinking of seeing you next, I see myself taking your hand and dropping to my knees. An instinctive worship the body somehow remembers to do. These gestures seem a bit hokey in the 20th century, but they are pure, I assure you, m'lady. Thank you. Whenever I read that poem, it makes me wonder, where does a 6 or 7-year-old boy in Bethesda, Maryland, come by this kind of chivalric romantic sensibility? It's almost an argument for reincarnation. Right? Something that the Gnostic Cathars who'd influenced the troubadours actually believed in. To surrender and allow the flow and direction of the unknown to permeate us can be a gateway into holy will and its freedom. It's to leave the mundane life with its familiar maps and road signs. It's to leave the historical self and the world of time behind. So I'll end this morning with a poem that has something of this bhakti sense of abandon swirling within it, and it's called The Lips of October. They've grown plump with presence, a pair of them living together at the entrance to your face. Gatekeepers, the faithful and voluptuous servants in your employ. Out of their intimate life together, meeting to share a wetness, a taste, a word, a sound. They now want a life of their own and to travel. Leaving the known, we return home. Leaving the known, we return home. October lips, the salmon are moving upstream. October geese, your lips lift into the great sky. I want. Their simple words sound like a kind of honking. And the wise animals who can find their way home 1,000 miles. When the wise animals inside us want to meet, they disappear into the alive darkness that descends facelessly. And I want to follow them and meet you in miraculous blackness, without a name, a past, a plan, lost, and at the same time, deeply found. I want to move with you into the slippery current in a country without maps or road signs, where only a familiar rightness guides the journey. And letting go is the only means of travel. Thank you.
Copies of this tape, as well as other works by Gary Rosenthal, may be ordered through the Point Bonita Books website. The web address is www.pointbonitabooks.com. That's www.pointbonitabooks.com. Books and tapes may also be ordered through Point Bonita Books' toll-free number, 1-800-429-1112.